listened to the Drew Marshall Show before?
George Bush is the Antichrist. Honest to
you
God.
You think George Bush is the Antichrist?
Yes.
Okay, so George Bush is the Antichrist because he's a nice guy.
He's a nice guy. He's fooling people. He's a trickster.
Would you vote for George W. Bush?
Absolutely.
Why? He's the Antichrist.
I think the guy needs to read his Bible.
Would you vote for George W. Bush?
Absolutely. I hope he's not the Antichrist, because then I'm going to vote for the wrong guy.
Yeah, I hate when that happens.
The Drew Marshall Show, right here on Joy 1250.
You're listening to the show that talks about stuff the others can't, don't, or won't. The Drew Marshall Show on Joy 1250.
Author, commentator, columnist Charles Colson is the founder of Prison Fellowship. His radio broadcast, Breakpoint, airs daily to 5 million listeners, folks. Count them, 5 million. Former counsel to President Richard Nixon, Mr. Colson converted to Christianity before spending time in prison on a Watergate-related charge. He's written more than 20 books, including Born Again, the contemporary spiritual classic Loving God, and with co-author Ellen Vaughn, the groundbreaking God and Government. His latest release, The Faith, Given Once for All, Jude 3, What Christians Believe, Why They Believe It, and Why It Matters. Mr. Colson identifies the unshakable tenets of the faith that Christians have believed through the centuries. Truths that offer a ground for faith in uncertain times, hope and joy for those who despair, and reconciliation for a world at war with God and itself. Joining us on the Drew Marshall Show, the one and only Mr. Chuck Colson. Thank you for your time, sir.
Drew, I'm delighted to be with you. That was quite a build-up you gave me. I hope I can live up to it.
You better be good.
I don't know, when you said earlier that there's a Catholic, a Presbyterian, and a raving evangelical, I guess I'm a raving evangelical.
You picked up on that, huh?
Yeah,
sorry about that. Well, you've done it again. Everything that seems to touch your pen seems to turn up gold.
Well, I'm not sure of that, but I try to write what I believe God's leading me to say. And about this particular book, The Faith, I have deeper convictions than probably any other book since Born Again, maybe excluding How Now Should We Live, because that was about biblical worldview, and I felt a real passion, and still do. I mean, I teach that now. But I think the reason that we are being defined by the atheists and by secular media, which is so hostile to us, and the reason we are being marginalized, both in Canada and the U.S., is that we've simply lost our own footing. We've forgotten what it is we believe, and we don't define it for the world, and we don't live it. So no wonder they're caricaturing us.
Well, apparently you are clearing up what Christians believe and what they don't believe. But I got to ask you, which Christians? I mean, Protestant evangelical fundamentalists? I mean, you're certainly not a representative of the emergent church.
No, I'm not, and I take that issue on in this book, on a chapter 4, which deals with truth. But I'm speaking for the faith entrusted to the saints once for all that Jude talked about in the first century, the apostolic faith. I've gone back in order to find common ground to the apostolic era when the Bible was being collected and put in place and canonized, and when all of the teaching was fresh in people's minds because the apostles had handed it down themselves. And so I'm trying to get that kernel of truth that is at the heart of true Christianity. And over the years, you know, you pick up a lot of barnacles on a ship when it's in the water. We've picked up a lot of barnacles. Well, let's strip them away and look what it is that all true Christians believe. When I say true Christians, I could use the word Orthodox, but that's out of favor with all our younger people. But that's what it really means. It means the faith given once for all.
So isn't this more or less you reasserting your position on the doctrines you hold to, much like MacArthur did in his book, The Truth War?
Oh, no, not at all. Very different. I've gone back and used as my theological guide a wonderful systematic theology on the early church, the patristic era, the fathers, the first four or five centuries of the church. And so I'm not making anything up. If there's anything new in here or anything that's Chuck Colson's doctrine, it's a mistake. All I'm trying to do is draw from the early teaching of the church, and that's when it was purest. We came through the Reformation. Protestants had certain battles, issues that they fought. Catholics have had doctrine developed over the years and lots of tradition added to what was originally taught. But there is one thing we can all, Protestant, Catholic, Orthodox, all varieties of evangelicals can agree to, and that is the basic, you look in the appendix of this book and you will see the 14 doctrines. And these are things that all true Christians believe in. Now, the emergent church is giving up on the Bible, so that they really don't agree with He Has Spoken.
Now, come on. That's a pretty... I mean, MacArthur's the king of the grandiose shotgun statements, but to say that the emergent church is giving up on the Bible, that's pretty huge.
Well, they say it themselves. Brian McLaren was just at Willow Creek. I read his speech. I was horrified. He rejects many of the very clear teachings of Scripture. And he says we have to find some new ground to meet people on, gracious orthodoxy.
Right.
No,
but if you had Chinese dinner with Brian face to face and said, Brian, do you reject the Bible? There's no way Brian's going to say yes to that.
I disagree with you. I think he would, in all honesty. I think he would have to. But one of the leaders of the emergent church, there's a big difference between emerging church, which I think is wonderful. These are young evangelicals who want to breathe new life into the
sure.
church and get us doing. Doing the good things, the good deeds, instead of just the good creeds. I'm all for them. But the emergent community, which is McLaren, and I don't want to use his name because he's a very popular preacher in America, but a young man who, in an interview with CT, Christianity Today, said that he used to think the Bible was true, now he realizes it's just it's all imagery. And I did a speech on his quotes without naming him. I don't want to embarrass him. And then I figured I ought to write him a letter. So I wrote him a letter. He's leader of one of the biggest churches in America. His books are selling like hotcakes.
First of all, good for you for writing him a letter.
Sure,
I was talking to Paul Young the other day, the author of The Shack, and I know
yeah.
I know many people, including yourself, are not big fans of The Shack. But
right.
It is amazing how many people don't make that effort to just say, look, I'm probably going on some assumptions here that are incorrect. Could we get together and chat? Now, I realize it's impossible to get together with everybody and have a little chat.
No, I've made this a practice, Drew. I'm glad you mentioned it, because if I've criticized any other brother of the faith, I have written him or communicated with him or talked to him personally face-to-face. And I did write to this one pastor I'm talking about. I wrote him a 4-page letter in which I laid out my views and what I thought was wrong with his position. And I said, I'm doing this privately. I've never mentioned you publicly, but here are your statements. Do you espouse these or not? And we ought to get together. I invited him to come meet with me, or I'd go meet with him.
Sure.
I got back a phone call, not a letter in response, in which he said, just tell Chuck a message. Just tell Chuck Colson we're joined at the hip. Well, we're not. But this is the postmodern mentality. The postmodern mentality is, you can have your truth, I can have my truth, and we're both still talking about the same truth. Well, we're not.
Yeah. You know, there's a part of me that wonders if this is simply a backlash against, I mean, we're talking about the postmodernal emergent scene. If that whole thing is a backlash towards the modernal, older generation, doctrinally entrenched, and then now you folks are kind of getting up on your horses and saying, all right, enough is enough. Let's clear things up here. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I do. But I'm trying to clear things up on the basis of what Lewis would call mere Christianity, or actually Richard Baxter, a Puritan pastor, centuries earlier called mere Christianity. Let's get back to the essentials of the faith.
Right.
Let's just talk about those things we all agree on. You'll notice in my book, I think it's quite remarkable, as a matter of fact, that a Catholic archbishop has endorsed the book with a ringing endorsement. So was the head of the Southern Baptist Convention, so was Bill Hybels, so was Rick Warren. I mean, it's amazing the cross-section of people who have endorsed this, but the reason is that I'm just taking the original truth that was given to us that we're supposed to be protecting and defending once for
yeah,
all.
Yeah.
I'm not inventing anything. As I said in the book, if there's anything new in here, it's a mistake.
On the phone with Charles Colson, better known as Chuck, and he is the author of The Faith Given Once for All, Jude 3, What Christians Believe, Why They Believe It, and Why It Matters. You know, last week, Chuck, a bunch of key evangelicals got together and launched the Evangelical Manifesto campaign.
Oh, yes, and I was in on the process while it was being drafted. I made a lot of suggestions, as many as I was able to. I spent hours doing it.
Okay, all right.
It got to him too late for them to make some of the changes.
Sure.
And there were parts of it I couldn't agree to.
Okay, well...
I also was objecting to the fact that they didn't invite a lot of people to sign it. I thought that was a serious mistake.
Well, from what I understand, this is the purpose behind this is sort of to declare who evangelicals are and what they stand for.
Well,
you know,
there should have been some African-Americans signing it, and there were none.
Yeah.
Until the last day, they got one fellow on the faculty.
Right.
It was a big mistake, and they didn't bring in the younger evangelicals. There were only 3 women signing the document. I couldn't sign it because it wasn't inclusive enough.
Well, I'll ask you the same question I asked those guys during the media launch in Washington last week. Why would the average Joe Pewsitter really care about all this relabeling? I mean, sure, the evangelical movers and shakers might care about damage control and image management of the evangelical scene, but why should the rest of us really care? So I guess the same question goes to you, Chuck.
Sure, that's a fair question. I think people who profess to be evangelical need to understand what that term means. I happen to believe there are evangelical Catholics, evangelical Orthodox, evangelical Protestants. The evangelical term derives from the Reformation, and the Reformation, reform, was a reform movement in the church. It was to bring the church back to the basics. It was to do exactly what this book, The Faith, is intending to do. That is, go back to the essentials of the faith. And they worked during the Reformation from the same systematic theologies I'm working from.
Hmm.
But people who profess to be reformers and want to bring the truth of the Scripture to bear on all of life and cultivate a personal relationship with Jesus need to know what it is we believe. And I think we've been so mischaracterized. I don't think it's a bad idea to try to explain what evangelicals believe. I just think we didn't do a very good job of it with this manifesto, and we left a lot of people out who should have been included.
Well, there's no question that in this day and age, especially in North America, but I would say especially in the United States, where you folks tend to wrap your Bible up in the flag, folks see us Jesus people, especially the evangelicals, as anti-homosexual, hypocritical, judgmental. You know, we're a two-trick pony. We always just rattle on about gays and abortion, gays and abortion, gays and abortion. You know, therefore, many have stopped actually just using the label Christian.
That's unfortunate. I know the book Unchristian because it's written by 2 friends of mine who are both bright young evangelicals who say this same thing. They say this is the way the young people perceive us. That's unfortunate because it is totally incorrect. I mean, I've spent the last 32 years, Drew, working in prisons, embracing people before we even knew where AIDS came from. I embraced a woman who was dying of AIDS in a cell in North Carolina, led her to Christ. I was hugging her. I didn't know where AIDS came from. Nobody did at the time.
So you did all this before the Princess Diana photo ops?
Oh, yeah, and I have been working with homosexuals in the prison, and so I'm certainly not homophobic. I do believe there is a natural moral order that needs to be followed, and certainly the Bible sets that forth for us. We have to interpret it in prudential terms, and we have to be concerned with the preservation of marriage. We have to be concerned with religious liberty. And a primary concern is the dignity of human life. I argue in this book that that's part of the gospel. Roman Catholics have something called Evangelium Vitae that was written by John Paul II, in which he says that the defense of life is part of the gospel. Well, if you're pro-choice, and you believe that, as I do, and most evangelicals do, then you can't ignore the life issue. It has to be central, and it plays out not just in abortion, it plays out in genetic engineering, it plays out in end-of-life questions, it plays out in caring for the poor and the prisoners. I go into the prisons because I think those inmates are made in the image of God and have every bit as much a claim on human dignity as I do, or you do.
On the phone with Chuck Colson, there's no question moral breakdown is happening all around us, even in our churches. But, Chuck, you say that because it's happening in our churches, it's happening in society. In other words, you believe that culture is religion incarnate.
I do. I believe that when you look at what's going on and you wring your hands over the terrible state of the culture, you ought to be looking in the mirror instead. Because where does the word culture come from? It comes from cult, which is the belief system. And basic belief system shapes the mores, habits, customs, attitudes, values of a people. And so what you see reflected in American life today is us. And it's not a pretty picture. I don't think it is in Canada either. And that's why I lay the blame right at the doorstep of the church. And unless we get our act together, there'll never be a reformation of the culture.
So when the church is sick, the culture's going to be sick.
Yeah, and when the church is healthy and thriving, Calvin said it, when the church is doing the job of the church, the culture around it inevitably is going to be transformed. He was right.
You know, that took forever for me to wrap my head around.
Well, it happens to be such a fundamental truth. And it's one of the reasons that we've given a bad image of Christians here in America, because politics, which you ought to be involved in because it's working for justice in society, but and God really cares about justice, and he cares about government preserving the order, so we have to care about the right ordering of government. But politics is nothing but an expression of culture. So if the culture is sick, the politics are going to be sick. And if we spend all our time as Christians trying to fix the politics and pay no attention to the culture, we're going to lose.
You know, I've always wanted to ask a smart guy like you, is it evangelical or evangelical?
I do it both ways, and I'm not sure which one is right.
Even the great Chuck Colson can't give me a straight answer on that one.
I can't on that one.
You know, do you think that most of these evangelicals are going to rally behind McCain?
I think the overwhelming majority of evangelicals in America will vote for a pro-life candidate. They will not vote for a pro-choice candidate.
You and I were chatting off air briefly about our guest later in the show, Anne Rice, best-selling author of The Vampire Chronicles.
Yep.
And I think you found out that she's endorsing Hillary. Is that right?
Well, she made a public statement saying she thought Hillary should be elected. This was after she came out and reaffirmed her Orthodox Catholic faith. And I believe a good Catholic is going to be a Catholic who believes what his church teaches. And the church teaches that the dignity and respect for life is part of the gospel itself. So I don't know how you could be pro-choice, which Hillary Clinton is, and at the same time say that you're going to be faithful to the teachings of your church, the teachings of Scripture, what it means to be a Christian.
Can a follower of Christ be a Democrat or a liberal?
Oh, can be a Democrat, he can be a liberal. One of the men who led me, discipled me in the early days of my own journey was a radical left-wing liberal Democratic politician from the state of Iowa, Harold Hughes. He was a recovered alcoholic. He was staunchly pro-life. As many of my Democratic friends today, I've got a lot of Democratic friends, they're staunchly pro-life, but they see ideology in a different way than a conservative does. So good luck to them. I mean, I certainly don't say you have to be dyed-in-the-wool Republican down the line religious right.
But come on, you know as well as I do that if you're a Jesus person down there in the United States and you say that you're a Democrat, there's an eyebrow-raising scenario that happens amongst the Republicans.
It's a little bit of man-bites-dog, but it's changing right now, and you're seeing a lot of that this year, although it is not changing on the central issue of life and the preservation of marriage. Those central issues remain, I would say, 95% of serious Christians, Catholic and Protestant, evangelical, would hold to those two tenets, and they'd have to swallow hard. Well, but your Democratic candidates are all saying they're against gay marriage.
Well, yeah, I mean, there's like an identity crisis going on down there in the United States right now, because you get all these Republicans, they're bleeding liberalism a little bit, and then you get all these Democrats that are bleeding some conservative values, and nobody knows who's who anymore.
I'm just writing about that. It's interesting you would raise that question, Drew. I'm doing an article for Christianity Today in the August issue that will be on that very subject, and it is the fact that conservatism and liberalism, classic doctrines, have both been hijacked by modern ideologues. And the Democrats call themselves liberal on many issues. They're very illiberal. Republicans call themselves conservatives on very issues. They're very unconservative. I'm trying to redefine conservatism because I consider myself a conservative.
But
conservative's first job is to preserve the moral order, and his second job is to live by revealed truth, which I think kind of characterizes what it means to be a Christian.
But Chuck, you are living in a day and age where definitions are being redefined purely because it's the day and age of redefinition.
Well, I want to take them back to what they really mean.
That's what I'm saying. It's like the, you know, pardon me for putting you in an age category here that doesn't sort of model your heart, because I know you're one of the gutsiest son of a guns out there, but, you know, the oldies are kind of going, whoa, 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 hold on a second. Enough with the redefining everything already, all right? Let's get back to where it was.
Well, it's not so much getting back to where it was. It is conservatism is a disposition. It's an attitude. And it rejects the biggest enemy of conservatism and the biggest enemy of the Bible is ideology. Ideology is a man-made formulation. And you're seeing ideology creep in and take over our political dialogue today. when we should really be talking about what are the fundamental truths that we really believe. What's at the heart of what we believe? I mean, I'm a classic liberal. Liberal was for self-government. Liberal was for the protection of the individual. I'm a classic liberal, but that's not what modern liberals call it, are concerned with. And so I think the terms need to be better understood, and the difference between liberalism classically and conservatism classically and modern ideology is stark, and that needs to be understood by people. Otherwise, we're going to be sucked into the political illusion.
Wow.
If we're not already.
Yeah. Chuck, Tony Campolo said to me one time that he is, and I resonate with this, although I think you're about to blow this one out of the water, but we'll see. He said that he is theologically conservative and socially liberal.
Well, I think there's an inconsistency in that, because if you're theologically conservative, you're going to look at the preservation of life as the essential ingredient in the preservation of the moral order. And, you know, you cannot take some of the positions Tony takes. I love Tony. He's an outrageous guy who loves to get people stirred up. He's actually done a great job in the kingdom because he's challenged a lot of our lethargy. He's kicked us in the butt when we've needed it. But like all guys like that, they suffer from the depression that they undergo when they're no longer in the headlines. So they come up with something ever more outrageous.
Come on.
Feeding that need.
You're just as cheeky as he is. You know, I know you don't fancy the emergent church, but the Bereans, those fine Bereans out there, they don't fancy you because of your ecumenical stance with Catholics. So basically, you know, the emergents and the Bereans, they're all wrong, but you and your doctrinal assertions are right.
Well, I noticed the first thing you challenged me on was John MacArthur, who thinks I'm a heretic because I believe that Catholics and evangelicals share a common root in the apostolic era.
Yeah.
If that makes me a heretic, so be it, because we do. That's a historic fact. You can't argue with it.
Can't we just all get along? Hey, can't we just hold hands and sing kumbaya?
You'd like to have in the evangelical and Christian. Let me not use that word. In the Christian church today, you'd like to have a really serious, meaningful conversation based upon what it is we were taught in the beginning. And let's get it straight. And let's not try to reinvent things. Every time, and this has gone on in every century. It started with the Gnostics in the first century, and it's going today in a variety of forms as people try to reinvent the gospel or reinvent a relationship with Jesus or enter into a new kind of a way of understanding it. You know, there's plenty of room for differences in how we perceive and how we live out things in our faith, but there's no difference in what we fundamentally believe if we claim to be Christian.
Chuck Olson, 35 years of following Christ. Not bad for a phony religious conversion.
Well, that's what a lot of people thought at the time. And either I was sincere or crazy. You've got to take one or the other now after 35 years.
7 months in prison about 32 years ago, I think.
Yeah, I got out of prison just about 32 years ago and started the ministry. And now we're in 114 countries around the world. Great ministry in Canada. Oh, my goodness. We got wonderful things going on in the prison. So.
But you're 76 years old. You got to slow down, man.
Well, people keep telling me that, but I love what I do, and I feel like it's God's call. So as long as you feel God's pleasure in what you're doing, do it. I can't imagine sitting around playing golf.
No. Well, I mean, and you suffer from the serious high driver syndrome. Scholarship to top university to start law school, earned your doctorate, became the youngest administrative assistant in the U.S. Senate, company officer in the Marine Corps during the Korean War, large successful law practice, and then you get this office next to the President of the United States.
But that's all for nothing, except to prepare me for what I'm doing now. That was all preparation. And it doesn't matter. God has taken whatever gifts I had and has consecrated them to his purposes, and that's all I care about in life. All of that was lost compared to the gain of knowing Christ.
You know, I don't want to turn this into yet another Chuck Colson sharing his testimony thing, because I've heard you do that time and time again, and I know there must be a tiring factor to that because there's so much more past that. But at the risk of beating a dead horse, so to speak, take us back to that night, will you? 1973, Tom Phillips. What was happening in your guts?
Well, for 6 months since the election ended, and I had masterminded the politics of the 1972 election, for 6 months I felt absolutely empty. Watergate was starting, and it looked like it was going to be a serious problem, but I thought I escaped it. That really wasn't the problem. The problem was I'd done everything I wanted to do. I was now 42 years old. I'd hit the top of the pile, and I kept looking around saying, is this all there is to it? What's next? And I met this man who was a client of mine. I'd known him before I went to the White House. Hadn't seen him in the 4 years I was in the White House.
This is Tom.
Tom Phillips, president of Raytheon Company, and he was totally changed. And I asked him what had happened to him, and he said, I've given my life to Jesus Christ, committed my life to Jesus Christ. And I almost fell off the chair. I changed the subject, but one summer night, hot summer night, I had was so despairing of my own life and my own self-worth and what I was doing. I just said, I got to go find out what this means. Called him, went over to his house one night. He read to me from Mere Christianity, a chapter on pride, the great sin. And it was like Lewis had written that for me. It was like a torpedo hitting me amidships. I was so crushed, shaken, convicted. And Tom wanted to pray with me, and I said, no, you know, you only pray in church. He prayed. I didn't pray. But I went out in the driveway that night to drive away, and, yeah, the tough guy in the Nixon White House and the ex-Marine captain, I couldn't drive the automobile out of the driveway. I was crying too hard for about an hour.
The Watergate hatchet man was bawling like a baby.
Yeah, and I thought the next day I'm going to get over this, and I was embarrassed because I'd never cry. I didn't like to cry. It was a sign of weakness. I felt so good the next day, and I started reading Mere Christianity, and that week it just all became clear to me. I knew exactly what had happened to me in that driveway. And I've never looked back, and never had a day since when I had any honest doubt.
Would you really have killed your own grandmother for your boss?
No, I never said so. Somebody who worked for me in an interview for the Wall Street Journal said, Chuck Colson, very flattering about brains and intelligence and drive. And,
right, right.
But he's so tough that he'd run over his own grandmother, so be careful. And then that got picked up in newspapers saying, I had boasted about it, I never did.
Yeah, yeah. I think it'd make a great epitaph if you put, I love my grandmother.
Yeah, well, that's what I may have to do.
Indicted for conspiracy to cover up the Watergate burglary. Was it really as big as media played it out to be?
The burglary wasn't. The burglary wasn't the problem. The burglary was a couple of romantic guys who got out of hand. And
but the cover-up was the problem.
The cover-up was the problem, sure. And it really wasn't a problem at first, but I don't think Nixon ever understood. I've just been listening to some old tapes because I'm going to write a foreword to a book that's being done about Nixon. Tapes between Nixon and myself. And
these weren't tapes that were found with a flashlight or anything like that, were they?
No. Okay. And the point of really was not clear to anybody what was going on, because the problem with the conspiracy is a lot of different people doing different things. No one person knows it all except John Dean. He was the only one who knew it all. And once he told the president, he then blew the whistle to save his own skin, as he wrote in his own memoirs. So it was a cover-up, and Nixon was told what to do and didn't do it, was indecisive for about 2 months, and then his presidency was lost.
You know, I've got three words that start with P, and I need your advice on this. President, patsy, and puppet. There's an impression out there that the president is pretty much just a patsy or a puppet.
You mean the present president?
Any president. You know,
Not true. Presidency is a very powerful office because you have the bully pulpit. Bush has not been able to make the most of it because he's not that good a communicator, but
he's a horrible communicator. When you've got George W. down in the South and you've got Jean Chrétien up in the North, I mean, we're talking two world leaders that couldn't put a sentence together.
Well, it's a it is a limitation. I happen to be a friend of Bush, and I have a lot of respect for him, and I appreciate what he's done, particularly in human rights. He's been tremendous.
But he's much better off the mic than he is on.
He's wonderful in close contact.
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
Sitting around talking with him, he's bright, quick, alert, sharp, very sharp. He gets on that, he just freezes on that screen. It's a tough thing in the television age.
Well, just before we say goodbye, there's a final thing here I just got to sort out because I've had a hard time getting this. Can you help me sort out the chronological events here? God gripped you in that driveway, but later you went to prison.
Yes, a year later I went to prison. In prison I saw how futile the system was and how helpless the guys were, and I really came to love them. And so when I got out of prison, I did not want to start a ministry. I had decided I'd go back to practice law, which I could. But I kept feeling the nudge to go back, and I started something which I thought I could pass off to someone else. And that today has spread all over the world, all over Canada, all over North America, and hundreds and hundreds of thousands of prisons, and 114 countries around the world. So that was God's doing, not mine, because I never planned to do it. And every step of the way, if I had time to tell you, every step of the way, the good things we've done were started without my knowing about it. Like Angel Tree, I didn't know about that. A woman got out of prison and started doing it in one town, and then it picked up and caught on and spread. Now it's in 50 countries. That was not part of my great strategic design.
Are you ready to die?
Yes, I think we all ought to be ready to die at any time, because you may at any time. You don't know how long life is going to last. I am certainly ready to meet Jesus. There are days when I heard Billy Graham say this one day, and I thought, this is not a good thing to say, but I now understand it. He said, I'm looking forward to the peace that I'll have when that happens, he said. And I think to live as Christ, to die as gain, as the Apostle Paul said, and I really believe that.
You know, you come across like a stalwart, like a rock, like the rudder. 35 years, I think, of following Christ, theologically, have you varied at any time? In other words, is there something you believe now that you didn't believe then, or that you used to believe then and you don't believe now?
Well, I can't tell you, because over this period of time, I've done a tremendous amount of studying. I've read systematic theologies. I've devoured some of the great classics of Christian literature. So I've been adding to my store of knowledge all the time. When I started out, I didn't understand what I've written in the faith when I first year or two as a Christian.
Really?
It took me quite a while to understand fully the complete doctrines of the faith. I did study systematic theologies after I got out of prison, but I still didn't have it. I think you grow all the time, and if once you stop growing, that is the time to die.
Chuck Colson, you are very, very easy to listen to, and I appreciate your time. This book, folks, is another winner. Again, The Faith, Given Once for All, Jude 3, What Christians Believe, Why They Believe It, and Why It Matters. I guess a summarizing question for you, Mr. Colson, is ultimately, what do you want to have happen in a person's life after reading your book?
Oh, I want them to become a serious disciple who really is able to defend his faith and live it, or her faith, and live it. And that's one of the... That's the goal of the Christian life. And look at the Great Commission. We evangelicals get evangelism all mixed up. The Great Commission says, go into all the world and make disciples. It doesn't say convert people or get a decision out of people. Make disciples and baptize them in the name of the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. Teach them all I have taught to you. That's the Great Commission. That's discipleship. And I think evangelism without discipleship is depriving people of the full teaching of the Christian faith.
Mr. Colson, I'll say hello to Mrs. Ann Rice for you.
Well, tell her I admire particularly her return to her faith, and I really appreciate her witness, and several of her books are... I've read them since her conversion. They're outstanding, but tell her my recommendation is she read Evangelium Vitae.
Hold on a second. I got to write this down. Evangelium Vitae.
Vitae, which is John Paul II's wonderful encyclical on life, the gospel of life.
John Paul II.
Yep.
Some great words from Chuck Colson. Appreciate your time again. Thank you.
Bless you, Drew. Good, keep up your good work in Canada. We need you.
Thanks, mate.
Thanks.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
I like that guy. I didn't know how I was going to take him. He leans pretty right, let me tell you. Folks, when we come back from our break, we're going to jump into our first talkback segment of the day, to spank or not to spank. It's been a while since we talked about this one. We were supposed to talk about it last weekend, but I was sick as a dog. Mother's Day weekend, I thought we might talk about corporal punishment. Some folks think if you spank, you're a child abuser. Some folks think if you don't spank, you're a tree-hugging hippie. Which side are you on? 905-338-1250. Let's get this out there, folks, once and for all. Later in the show, Anne Rice, the best-selling author of The Vampire Chronicles. We'll be right back.
Like what you've heard? Listen again online at drewmarshall.ca.